community. They're not like field hands, you know, they enjoy some sort of immunity because they're students. And the sheriff comes in and at the point of the gun forces them to work on the levee, just like field hands. But Frank soon gave up that sort of social realism. He said, Jerry Manning, I didn't hear him say this, but Jerry quoted him, said, "You guys go on and write that kind of artistic stuff. I'm going to go ahead and make $1 million. We didn't believe him at the time, but he did.
By
writing those Schwartzmuth books.
Frank Yerby is the least important person of writers in revolt. Perhaps the nature of the writing, Jack, back in those days, sometimes it seems quaint to others, yet with a rugged power, even now, looking back at some of the writing. The difference you see from the writings of the 30s and today, what would you say, Jack?
Well, there's a difference in the emphasis about the issues, you know. I might say that I don't know most of the young writers, they don't know what the hell they're rebelling against, for one thing. Now, I'm interested in this phenomenon we see of the communes. I slept in one here in Chicago. Some young people going together, buying an old house and living in a communal arrangement. Now, that's nice. I think it's nice. There's a spirit of self-help. They're nice people, but what does that do to the system, I wonder, you know? Now, in the 30s, we rebelled against the system. We went into picket lines. We got our heads bashed and that sort of thing. I don't see that being done anymore.
But isn't there something else happening, Jack, more subtly? In the 30s, there were people doing it, but there was always a minority doing it, and the many went along.
Yeah.
But today, more and more seem to be questioning in a different way. Do you sense, I know you're way out there in Moberly, but you're in touch with the world, and there's some sort of a vague discontent.
I get vibes, you know.
Yeah,
only bad vibes.
By the way, are you working on your memoirs?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I actually am. I really, you know, you seem skeptical of me about that.
I'm just hoping.
You're thinking
you
of the old Conroy, the bibulous Conroy. I'm a changed man. I told you I haven't had a drink for 3 years. Look at me. Don't I look the picture of hell?
On that subject, look at me. Can you remember that phrase, "You're the collector of folklore, Midland humor," and the great brag phrases?
The ringtail roar.
You remember some of those phrases in the ringtail roar?
Well,
a Mark Twain sort of guy.
Yeah, you know, where they threaten one another with all sorts of disasters, that sort of thing. Mark Twain in Life on the Mississippi has a good section about that, where these two ringtail roars are threatening one another with all kind of blood and mayhem, and the smallest man on the raft, they're floating down the Mississippi on a raft, the smallest man on the raft gets tired of it, jumps up and bumps their heads together and knocks them unconscious.
And the ringtail roar, half a horse and half an alligator.
Half horse and half
alligator. Related on his cousin's side to a cyclone, related to death and destruction. They
have Sal Fink, the Mississippi, who was a female ringtail roar. Fink, the Mississippi screamer.
And she was in there.
Then she's Mike Fink's daughter, you know.
Mike Fink's daughter?
Yeah.
In this book,
Mississippi
Midland, in this book, Midland Humor, Jack, suppose you read something that you yourself uncovered. It's a hard shelf Baptist sermon.
Harp of a thousand strings.
Yeah, could you set the scene for the sermon?
It's a pity a professional isn't here who has the advantage of being a minister's son. Our old friend Win Strachey.
He'd read that, I know.
Who unfortunately he made a record of it. Unfortunately, he's absent in Mexico, but he was very taken with it.
Jack?
I did, because it had been obscure for many years.
Where'd you find this particular?
In an old book somewhere. I looked around among old books, you know. It was it's a burlesque sermon, really, and comedians used it for a long time, but it did languish in obscurity for many, many years, till I found it somewhere and published it here. Mm-hmm. So it got around a little here. It's a hard-shell Baptist sermon called The Harp of a Thousand Strings, and it begins in this way. "I may say to you, my brethren, that I am not an educated man, and I am not one of them as believes that education is necessary for a gospel minister. For I believe the Lord educates his preacher just as he wants him to be educated. And although I say it that oughtn't to say it, yet in the state of Indiana where I live, there's no man as gets bigger congregations nor what I gets. There may be some here today, my brethren, as don't know what persuasion I am of. Well, I say to you, my brethren, I'm a hard shell Baptist. There are some folks as don't like the hard shell Baptist. But I'd rather have a hard shell as no shell at all. You see me here today, my brethren, dressed up in my fine clothes. You might think I am proud, but I am not proud, my brethren. And although I've been a preacher of the gospel for 20 years, and although I'm captain of the flatboat that lies at your landing, I'm not proud, my brethren. I'm not going to tell you exactly where my text may be found. Suffice to say it's in the Bible, and you will find it somewhere between the first chapter of the book of Generations and the last chapter of the book of Revolutions. And if you will go and search the scriptures, you'll not only find my text there, but a great many other texts that will do you good to read. And my text, when you shall find it, you shall find it to read thus: And he played on a harp of a thousand strings, spirits of just men made perfect. My text, my brethren, leads me to speak of spirits. Now there's a great many kinds of spirits in the world. In the first place are the spirits that some folks call ghosts. And there are the spirits of turpentine. And there's the spirits that some folks call liquor. And I've got as good an article of them kind of spirits on my flatboat as was ever foxed down the Mississippi. But there's a great many other kind of spirits, for the text says, And he played on the harp of a thousand strings, the spirits of just men made perfect. But I'll tell you the kind of spirits as it meant in the text is fire. That's the kind of spirits as it meant in the text, my brethren. Now there's a great many kinds of fire in the world. In the first place, there's the common sort of fire you light your cigar pipe with. And then there's foxfire and campfire, fire before you're ready, and fire and fall back, and many other kinds of fire. For the text says, He played on the harp of a thousand strings, spirits of just men made perfect. But I'll tell you the kind of fire that's been in the text, my brother, it's hellfire. And that's the kind of fire that a great many of you is going to come to if you don't do better than what you're doing now. For he played on the harp of a thousand strings, the spirits of just men made perfect. Now the different sorts of fire in the world may be likened unto the different persuasions of Christians in the world. In the first place, we have the Episcopalians. And they are a high-sailing and high-polluting set, and they may be likened unto a turkey buzzard, and flies up into the air, and up he goes, and up, till he looks no bigger than your fingernail. And the first thing you know, he comes down and down and down, and is feeling himself on the carcass of a dead horse by the side of the road. And he played on the harp of a thousand strings, the spirits of just men made perfect. And then there's the Methodist, and they may be likened unto the squirrel running up into a tree, for the Methodist believes in going from one degree of grace to another, and finally on to perfection. And the squirrel goes up and up and up and up, and he jumped from limb to limb and branch to branch, and the first thing you know, he falls, and down he comes kerflummox. And that's like the Methodist, for they has always fallen from grace. And he played on the harp of a thousand strings, the spirits of just men made perfect. And there, my brethren, there's the Baptist, and they have been likened to a possum on a cinnamon tree. And the thunders may roll and the earth may quake, but that possum clings there still. And you may shake one foot loose, and the other's there. And you shake all feet loose, and he lacks his tail around the limb and clings forever. For he played on the harp of a thousand strings, the spirits of just men made perfect.
Well, Jack Conroy, big question, Brother Conroy. How come you never became a preacher?
Well, what makes you think I'm not?
Which leads to another subject.
Since I reformed.
Well, Jack, you always get those little throwaways from Randallsville, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah,
and
you've
been sending scores of these tracts, The Evils of Paul.
I reformed myself, yeah.
Or The Evils of Tobacco.
Once called, Are We Dragging Men to Hell with Our Modern Dress? You know that one.
How's that go?
Well, I've got one there, but I'm not going to bother to get it. The situation is it's anachronistic in the first place. A preacher boards a Chicago streetcar, and across him is a woman, a thing, he calls her, who is very careless about the way her skirt is arranged. And the preacher says he can see more than a clean man should see, you see. And the moral, as I see it, is that preachers should not get on streetcars. That danger has been removed here, but I suppose there are other
people. But, Jack, did they catch on, the people around them? Because you used to send for thousands of them. They thought they had a real
country. I get a bale of them every year. I've got a certificate on my wall which apprises me of my rights if the police should interfere with my passing the track. I'm pass tractor number 53 in that big organization. You see, and that's high up in the organization.
I named Midland Humor this book that's now out of print. It's a very collector's item. You collected the humor of Bill Nye, of Twain, of the early writers, and there's Julia A. Moore, the sweet singer of Michigan, a farm wife who lived in the middle of the 19th century to the 20th. Who was Julia Moore, the sweet singer of Michigan?
Well, Julia Moore was a farm wife who got to writing this poetry, and she had it published probably at her own expense, and sent it around, and wags such as Bill Nye and at the time, you know, for a lark, they would praise it to the skies, you know. She took it all seriously. Bill Nye would say things like, Shakespeare never wrote verse like this. She was perfectly true, of course, you know. She took it in the wrong way, you know. Mark Twain is indebted to her for the obituary verses, you know, that he has in the girl who used to write obituaries for dead people in the neighborhood.
In Huck Finn.
He's indebted to Julia Moore.
So why don't you read one of Julia Moore's classics, one of
well, yes, but let me go on to say that she had modern influences to Ogden Nash.
Mm-hmm.
It acknowledges that Julia Moore taught him something of odd rhyming, you know, with odd and convoluted rhyme.
Uh-huh.
He gave credit to Julia A. Moore for inspiration in that field. But I'll read a little Livy for you. One mortal spirit to heaven has flown to dwell in that mansion above, where dear little angels together roam in God's everlasting love. One little flower has withered and died, a bud nearly ready to bloom. In life on earth, its life on earth is marked with pride. Oh, sad, it should die so soon. Sweet little Libby, that precious flower, was a pride in her parents' home. They miss their little girl every hour, those friends that are left to mourn. Her sweet silvery voice no more is heard in the home where she once roamed. Her place is vacant around the hearth where her friends are mourning, lone. They are mourning the loss of a little girl with black eyes and auburn hair. She was a treasure to them in this world, this beautiful child so fair. One morning in April, a short time ago, Libby was active and gay. Her savior called her. She had to go at the close of that present day. While eating dinner, this dear little child was choked on a piece of beef. Doctors came, tried their skills a while, but none could give relief. She was 10 years old, I am told, and in school stood very high. Her little form now the earth enfolds. In her embrace it must ever lie. Her friends and schoolmates will not forget little Libby that is no more. She is waiting on the shining step to welcome friends home once more.
That's better than Edgar Guest.
Yeah, it is better. Similar.
It takes a heap of living to make a home. Thinking, Jack, the nature of the humor is in that very book that I borrowed so much. Resort Peter DeVries, Different Culture Levels Eat Here.
Oh, yeah, that Different Culture Levels Eat Here, yeah.
Jack, we'll take a slight pause for a moment in the conversation with Jack Conroy, who's a man of many colors, in a literary sense and a human sense. Jack, the editor of the 30s, and a very influential one, of the Anvil, the new Anvil, Writers in Revolt, is the paperback now available. And has some quite powerful writing. Some may seem dated, but it doesn't matter. The fact is, at that moment, powerful, and some hold up indeed very well. You can see where some of the lyricism of Nelson Algren came from, and we'll perhaps even, I'll take the liberty of reading a little bit of Marital to Sewer later on from this book. And we'll pause for a moment and ask about your children's books, too. And, well, you've tried some Italian, you've tried Romana Clef on me, and I say, un momento.
Yeah.
In Nottingham Town, not a soul would look up, not a soul would look up.
From Kentucky, which has had a profound influence on the American folk song revival. In the 1950s, she was the figure who introduced the Southern Appalachian dulcimer to urban audiences in the North. Her singing style has inspired such performers as Peggy Seeger and Joan Baez. My name is Maury Bernstein, your host for Folk Music and Bernstein each Friday night at 11 here on MER. It's my pleasure to announce that Gene Ritchie will be spending a week in residency at the end of April here in the Twin Cities at the University of Minnesota, augmented by two radio programs recorded before a live audience for my Folk Music and Bernstein series at McAllister College in St. Paul. Gene's last appearance in the Twin Cities was a sold-out concert at the Guthrie Theater a decade ago, a concert he did with the then-unknown Doc Watson. Gene's appearances in the Twin Cities at the end of April are underwritten in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They will be taped for broadcast throughout the United States. Included will be a free public concert at the University of Minnesota, a dulcimer workshop, also free to the public, and broadcast concerts for Folk Music and Bernstein recorded in front of a live audience. It all takes place the last week in April, here in the Twin Cities. Gene Ritchie in residency. Why not consult your newspaper for further details or listen to Happenings with Arthur Hayne here on MER.
You've traveled abroad more than I have.
I know a word or two here and there.
Oh, French.
Oh, the French, I can say au revoir,
sure, yes,
bonjour,
you've heard me talking French,
things like that. Jack, there's another aspect of your writings that is too little known. Just as Woody Guthrie wrote marvelous children's songs, you've written some beautiful books for children, The Fast Sooner Hound, Slappy.
Well, I resent you saying they're little known, you know, Stud. That Fast Sooner Hound is the most successful book I ever wrote, with Montauk.
No, I mean, it should be
more than 200,000 copies.
Was it really?
Yeah.
The Fast Sooner Hound.
We're in that neighborhood, and that's a good neighborhood for anyone.
Is that available, Fast Sooner
Yeah,
Hound?
It's still in print. Published in 1942.
The Fast Sooner Hound.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell the story, your own?
Well, you'll have to sort of telescope it. I heard the story, or the germ of it, and there is a folk basis for it, about a dog a boomer fireman had, who didn't look very much to look at him, kind of a mangy old hound, but who would outrun the fastest trains on the road. So the way the story developed, Arna and I were working together at the Rosenwald Fund. They're collecting the material for They Seek a City. And this, by the way, Studs, as you may recognize, is part of a collection of industrial folklore that I have in Ben Botkin's collection, you know, A Treasure of American Folklore.
Quite up. Ben Botkin did some quite remarkable stuff for the Federal Writers Project, and that was oral history, too.
Yeah, that's
all
right.
All sorts of
stories. I have about 8 or 10 of these, and then Sooner Hound was one of them. And they were sent off to Houghton Mifflin with the hope that they could be made into a volume. And Hardwick Moseley, I don't know whether you remember or not, he was the local representative, later a vice president of the firm, saw the Sooner Hound story, and he said they didn't want to publish the collection as an adult story, but he said, hey, this would make a marvelous children's story. Well, I didn't think much of it, but Arna, who had written some children's books, said, why not collaborate on it? So we did, and that was the result. But the story, a boomer fireman comes into town, and he goes to the roadmaster and asks for a job. And he said, well, you look like a man who could keep the steam up. But he said, what about that dog? What are you going to do with him? You know, a boomer travels from road to road. He doesn't have any fixed place, and he usually doesn't have any place to stay, at least when he gets into town. He said, oh, he's no trouble. He says he'll go along with me. So the roadmaster takes a little umbrage at this. He said, well, no. He said, there's a law against that. Don't you know there's a no passenger law in the caboose? He can't ride in the caboose. It applies not only to people, but it applies to dogs or anything else. He said, he doesn't ride in the caboose. He runs alongside. So the roadmaster takes a little umbrage and says, well, we got some pretty fast freights on this road. I'll put him on the local freight. So they put the hound and his master on the local freight. Well, the hound is bored by the whole thing. He goes off in the fields, chases rabbits and that sort of thing, gets up ahead and looks to see if the train's coming. And the roadmaster said, this is giving the road a bad name.
The Fast Sooner Hound is beating the train.
Oh, yeah. Way ahead, looking back to see if it was coming, wondering where it was. The road master says, this is giving the road a bad name. Nobody will ship. Why, if they ship a calf to Chicago, it'd be a baloney bull before they got there, they think. So he says, I'll put him on a fast freight. So they put him on a fast freight with similar results, and he beat it easily. Not quite so easily, but very easily. He said, all right, I'll put him on a passenger run. So the passenger ran the similar thing, the sooner arm was always ahead. And he said, well, I can't stand this sort of thing. I'm going to put you on the streamline cannonball. That'll fix that sooner arm. So it became quite a bit. The word got around what was going to happen, you know. They spiked down the rails for three counties, so the sooner arm could race the cannonball.
Everybody's watching us.
Everybody's watching us. Watch. Factories took time off. Schools were let out. They're all lined along the road. So off they go, you know. It took three men to see the train on that run. One would say, there she comes. The other said, there she is. And the other said, there she goes.
There she was.
Yeah, there she was. The wheels were 10 feet off the ground. The rails sang like a violin for 5 hours after the train passed through. So they're going on a good clip. The roadmaster goes along to see that the fireman doesn't soldier on the job. See that he really does his job. So he's shoveling away. He shoveled down to a nub, you know, shoveling in the coal. He's a sport. He says, my sooner's true blue. Not going to take advantage of the road. So the roadmaster looks out. He said, don't see the sooner anywhere. Don't see him anywhere. We beat him. We beat that sooner for true. The fireman says, I can't understand that. My sooner never let me down. Leave me take a look. So he looks out, and the wind is coming so fast it blows his cap off his head. He looks up and down. Now, I'm going to give the one in the Treasure of Folklore, not the one in the Children's Book, which would be all right in these days, a bold expression. The boomer says, he's there all right. My sooner's still true blue. He says, what do you mean? He says, why, that sooner is so true blue, he doesn't want to take advantage of the railroad. And every hot box, every journal box on this train is blazing like everything. And the sooner hound is the fastest thing on four legs. He says, it's the fastest thing on wheels, but he's the fastest thing on four legs. Except he's only using three of them now. He's running up and down the train, putting out those hot boxes. He's a real sport.
So he beat the train.
He beat it.
He beat the cannonball.
On ahead, yeah.
So that's the story of the fast sooner hound. I was thinking, Jackson, you were railroads, and you like your interests are many and varied. Certain singers you like, just as Woody. You also liked a more sentimental singer of the 20s, Vernon Dalhart.
Oh, yes. That was the grand opera singer who went to took to folk singing.
Yeah.
And he had formal training, which most folk singers didn't, but I don't think his formal training hurt him any, do you?
He's best known for the Prisoner Song. But the one I thought of sort of would fit the fast sooner hound is the one you like, The Wreck of the Old 97.
The Wreck of the Old 97.
It's Vernon Dalhart.
Watch old 97 roll. mighty rough road from Lynchburg to Danville and a line on a 3 mile grade. It was on that grade that he lost his average, and you see what a jump he made. Going down grade, making 90 mile an hour, when his whistle broke into a scream. He was found in the wreck with his hand on the throttle and a skull dead to death with a beam. Now, ladies, you must take warning from this time now and on. Never speak hard words your true love and husband, he may leave you and never return.
Listen to Vernon Dalhart. Of course, many thoughts come to your mind, Jack. I remember you at many parties in the series singing, "If My Mother Was a Lady," letter edged in black.
Yeah, but don't ask me today, Stud. No. I told you about my experience with those 17 drunken Irishmen and one Swede the other night.
Yeah.
At Joe Nash's.
You don't sing anymore, huh?
Well, under these circumstances, yeah. I don't know.
Jack?
I never sang for my father. Who's...
Robert Anderson. Before I ask you more about Writers in Revolt, the Amble, and particularly about Marital of Sewer, you're pointing out something else in Midland Humor that you collected.
Yeah.
Eugene Field.
Yeah, Eugene Field. This is always my... you know, I had a hell of a time finding something called the Tribune Primer. Now, this doesn't refer to the Chicago Tribune, but the Denver Tribune, on which Eugene Field worked when a young man. And he compiled this sardonic advice to children, you know, about and for children. Some of it has sort of precursors of the black humor we find on today. You see, I'll read an excerpt or two. The first one is called The Coal Hod. Oh, how nice and black the coal hod is. Run, children, run quick, and put your little fat hands in it. Mercy me, your hands are as black as the coal hod now. Hark, Mommy is coming. She will spank you when she finds your hands so dirty. Better go and rub the black dirt off on the wallpaper before she comes.
Yeah. That's a far cry from Little Boy Blue.
This is the poor Little Boy Blue. Now, this foolish roach, I don't like to read about lunchtime, but since this won't be broadcast until later,
mm-hmm.
It won't be heard now. The foolish roach. This is a cockroach. He is big, black, and ugly. He is crawling over the pillow. Do not say a word, but lie still and keep your mouth open. He will crawl into your mouth, and you can bite him in two. This will teach him to be more discreet in the future. I like this one, the bottle. This is a bottle. What is in the bottle? Very bad whiskey. It has been sent to the local editor. He did not buy it. If he had bought the whiskey, it would be even worse than it is. Little children, you must never drink bad whiskey.
Jack, I'm thinking that book, by the way, Midland Humor, which I use a reference very often, probably can be found in secondhand bookstores of people.
Yes, it's out of print. Yeah,
but I'm thinking also of one of my favorites of your writings, aside from Disinherited and your being an editor, is another children's book, and that to me deals with a rather important theme, craftsmanship, and the end of it in a way. And it's it's Slappy Hooper, The Wonderful Sign Painter.
Yeah.
How'd that come about?
Well, you mean how did it begin?
What'd you find about Slappy Hooper?
Yeah, Slappy Hooper, The Wonderful Sign Painter. Some old sign painter told me a story, sort of the germ of it, about a sign painter who was so good that he painted the billboard with a loaf of bread on it, and the birds came along and pecked at it, and it pecked at it so hard that they broke their bills off. And the SPCA got a hold of it and caused them trouble. That was the germ of the whole thing, you see. So I conceived this idea of Slappy Hooper, the wonderful sign painter. He's a man who takes pride in his craft. He does everything by hand, you know. So I learned some of the technical things of the sign painter from this old sign painter, whom I met over on North Clark Street. Mm-hmm. You remember when North Clark was a convivial King's Palace, where they had the cuckoo hour, when at a certain time you could get two shots of whiskey for 11 cents.
That was our cocktail hour, cuckoo hour.
Cuckoo hour. Yeah. The waiters would go around singing cuckoo, cuckoo.
Yeah, that was it. Two shots for 11 cents.
The first shot, they give you a second one for a penny. That's what I meant.
And, of course, Bunkhouse Square was alive and going.
Oh, God, yeah, it's dead now. We, Frank Mead and I passed by it on the way.
Frank, he said the railroad man.
It's not like the old days. All the old orators are gone. But anyhow, this business of painting a sign with a pounce, he said it's a bag of chalk that they use a stencil to, mm-hmm. you know. Slappy wouldn't do that. He did it all freehand. Everything was freehand.
I remember that story. Slappy also painted in the sky long before airplanes came around. Slappy used to use sky hooks.
Yeah.
He hooked them into the clouds.
They never tell how he did it. But they thought he hooked them on the clouds, yeah.
What were sky hooks?
Well, he never would tell. He'd go up there and he'd find Sloan's liniment sign, you know, stretched from coast to coast, yeah. And he complained that the airplanes were coming around tearing his signs down, you know. Everything was going against him, the mechanical age, you know.
A man could take a train all the way from Boston to San Francisco.
See the sign.
Sloan's liniment.
Up in the air, yes.
And then, of course, they'd get a sore neck from looking up.
Sore neck, then they'd buy the liniment.
Yeah. Well, Slappy, in a way, he's sort of a Paul Bunyan of sign
painting. Yeah, of sign painting, yeah.
He was a Pecos Bill and a Paul Bunyan.
Yeah. And there's the episode, of course, where he painted the climactic episode of the stove, you know.
What?
I'm trying to think of some of the ones that...
Describe that stove, painting that stove.
Yeah. He'd go along and he'd get fired. He got into trouble
because he was
too realistic.
Because he was too good.
Too
he
good.
Got fired because he was too good.
The episode, the basic episode of the sign painter told me about the birds and the loaf of bread. They wouldn't have him around. Had to get out of town. But he had his kit, you know, all he needed was his brushes. He was a craftsman, you know. Didn't need any stencils or anything like that. So he comes on the stove company. His reputation isn't known, you know. You can't tell who he is because his reputation is spreading. A bad reputation for being too good at his craft. Yeah.
So it's the Jim Dandy. I remember the Jim Dandy Hot Stove Company hires him to paint a stove on a billboard.
Hot Blast Stove Company.
And what happened?
Yeah, well, he said the manager of the stove company said, I want you to paint that stove so it looks like there's a fire in it. And he says, oh, sure, I can do that. He paints it a nice red. So it looks so realistic that the hobos come from miles around, warming themselves by it. And they even hang the shave water up on it, becomes a nuisance. The city authority has said, get that sign down from there so these hobos will get out of town. And the stove company man likes his sign because it's a good advertisement for the stove. He said, well, I don't want to get rid of the signboard. He said, what shall I do? And he said, I'll tell you what you do. You paint that signboard so hot that it'll drive the bums away. So Slappy does it. He paints it real cherry red. Well, the upshot, as you remember, is that he painted so hot it sets all the buildings afire, all around, yeah. And he's chased out of town again. Too good for his own good.
Too good. He was chased out of town as a pyromaniac.
Yeah, pyromaniac. Course,
and then he was doing something. He was doing something for a guy running for sheriff.
Yeah.
And he painted a sign of the sheriff and some
his
of
his rival came along and took a shot at it. It looks surreal. Yeah.
He thought it was the actual sheriff.
Yeah, the actual sheriff. And there was a cow. He said the situation comes up. The boy's asking him questions, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
He's talking to a boy sitting sadly on a bench. That's what the to him.
Why he lose?
He said, why? He said, they didn't care him shooting at the sheriff if he'd shot the real sheriff. And I said, well, what was the trouble then? Well, he said there was a cow named Dolores behind the sign. And she was the only milk cow in the county. And the bullet hit her and drove her into the next county. It took 2 weeks to find her. And in the meantime, the little children were without a milk. He said, that's the reason they run Slappy out of town, on account of the cow. Not on account of shooting the sheriff. Picture.
You know, Jack, as you write that marvelous children's story so many years ago, Slappy, you start thinking how true that craftsmanship itself sometimes is penalized.
Yeah, it is to this day, yeah.
Slappy was too good.
We like to put a moral into our story that isn't obvious. And, you know, strangely enough, we get reports around from children. The teachers have their children read these books, and they sometimes dig it, as the saying goes nowadays, you know. Like the Sooner Hound. Like a man or anybody, they may look unprepossessing, they're ragged or something like that, but they may have virtues that are not visible, you know. Yeah. They're good enough to beat people who look more prosperous or more fast. And of course, with Slappy Hooper, the values of craftsmanship.
You know, Jack, I'm thinking, you know, we're talking, and I know that you and I could talk for hours as you reminisce about your life and writing and the people you've encouraged. The book itself, Writers in Revolt, Writing of the 30s, has been reissued. Your introduction. It has Nelson Auburn, Younger Days, and Erskine Cole's poetry, as well as short stories by Nelson Langston Hughes is in here, and Stuart Engstrand and James D. Farrell, for that matter, and quite a few other writers, and Merritt, but I think of Merritt LeSueur.
Yeah.
You know, this remarkable woman for half a century.
She's still going strong, so I had a phone call from her the other day.
I'm thinking of
they're giving a party for her in Minneapolis.
I'm thinking of two of her stories in here that are so applicable today.
Yeah.
We think of women's movement. Here's about women's conditions. Sequel to Love. And the other one is called They Follow Us Girls. Just perhaps just a couple of paragraphs to give people an idea of how true Marital is. And this is called Sequel to Love from Jack's collection, A Writer's in Revolt. I am in the place where they keep the feeble mind of the parable. This place is full of girls moaning and moaning all night, so I can't get no sleep and to speak up. They won't let me out of here if I don't get sterilized. I've been crying for about 3 weeks. I'd rather stay here in this hole with the cracked ones and have that done to me. That's a sin and a crime. It's almost like one flew over the cuckoo's nest in a way. I can't be sleeping hardly ever any night, yet I'd stay right here and have that sin done to me because I won't be in any pleasure with man, and that's all the pleasure I've had. Workers ain't supposed to have any pleasure, and now they're taking that away because it ain't supposed to be doing anybody any good, and they're afraid I'll have another baby. And she writes about this, and toward the end she says, they don't want us to have nothing. Now they want to sterilize, so we won't have that. They do it all the time, and we hear about the sterilization cases. They do it all the time, and the police follow a girl around. The police women follow you around to see if you're doing anything, and then they nab you up, give you a lot of tests, send you here and do this to you. They don't want us to have nothing, all right. And now I'm locked up there with the people minded. And this one about a girl on relief. And what they do to her. No word relief was used those days. Welfare today. So here she writes about women, poor women, women up against it. And Marital LeSueur wrote this in the 30s, yet it's so 1970.
Yes, what they call, you know, such contemporary relevance is a phrase that's used much nowadays. I use it myself when I can work it in.
Jack, I'm thinking now as we say goodbye, and for now the hour has gone quickly. We've just touched on...
Well, it's been pleasant, Stud.
We'll go have us something non-spiritus for Menti.
Yeah, not for me.
Non-spiritus.
Yeah, that dreary diet cola and tag. That's the kind of thing. How has the mighty fallen, Stud?
We know how the mighty have risen. Yeah. We'll soon be reading your memoirs, Jack. I hope one day soon
The Iceman doesn't come at first.
No. Jack Conroy. You know the old phrase, Woody Guthrie, I borrowed from Woody, and he borrowed from old folklore, and how it goes, take it easy, but take it.
And so long, it's been good to know you.
So long, it's been good to know you. Jack Conroy.
Next week, actress Vivica Lynfors talks with Studs about her new program, I Am a Woman, and the various aspects of woman described therein. During the conversation, Miss Lynfors performs a number of excerpts from her program. Studs Terkel interviews are recorded in the studios of WFMT, Chicago. This is listener-supported radio in Minnesota. Thank you.
Serving the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area, this is KSJN at 91.1 FM with transmission facilities in Shoreview.
The following program is broadcast with the financial assistance of Northern States Power Company. From the Historic Academy of Music in Philadelphia, we present another recorded concert by the Philadelphia Orchestra, Eugene Ormandy, music director and permanent conductor. Today, William Smith, the orchestra's assistant conductor, leads an all-Mozart program. The first portion will consist of the Overture to the Magic Flute and Concerto No. 4 in D major for violin and orchestra, Kechel 218, in which the soloist will be Piotr Janowski. After intermission, Alexander Heller will appear as soloist in Mozart's Concerto in B-flat major for bassoon and orchestra, Kechel 191, and William Smith will conclude the concert with Symphony No. 41 in C major, Kechel 551, The Jupiter. Music commentary for the Philadelphia Orchestra broadcasts is based on program notes by George K. Deal, program annotator for the Philadelphia Orchestra and chairman of the Fine Arts Department at LaSalle College. And this is James Keelan. This concert is coming to you from the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. William Smith will open today's All Mozart program by the Philadelphia Orchestra with the Overture to the Magic Flute. There are two ways in which set designers usually approach this opera. It is viewed either as a work full of symbolism and philosophy, espousing the virtues of justice, humanity, and universal brotherhood, or as a simple, unassuming fairy tale. There is, of course, a third possibility, and that is to see it as a mixture of the two. And who is to say that the Magic Flute does not contain elements of both? Through the magic of his dramatic and musical talents, Mozart has, in this, his last opera, unified a number of disparate elements so that they reflect the temper of his genius in its full maturity. Joseph Kerman enumerates them, opera seria arias and opera buffa ensembles, panpipe scales and an overture with a real fugal theme, Masonic fanfares and a Lutheran chorale, which sounds like Bach, Viennese street songs, and as Shaw said, the only music yet written fit for the mouth of God. The overture to this theatrical masterpiece begins its opening adagio section with three stately chords, which are heard at significant points in the opera, and constitute the only material derived directly from the score. What follows is a marvel of contrapuntal excitement delivered in that mercurial manner for which Mozart's nimble mind is justly famous. These 200 measures dispel any doubts that counterpoint can be dazzling. The audience in the Academy of Music welcomes William Smith, who in a moment will conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra with the overture to Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute.